International Edition. On our new program, taking a closer look at stories of the day, social media, and entertainment. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a possible shifting of strength in the Syrian crisis. A plea for UN pressure on Saudi Arabia to stop attacks on Yemen. Human Rights Watch makes an appeal to FIFA.
What we're looking for any new president to ensure that human rights are a key element of any decision for future tournaments.
Searching for life on a mysterious Jupiter moon. The Hubble telescope, the gift that keeps on giving, and talking country music. It's all ahead for you coming up right here on The Voice of America. News reports say there is a buildup underway in the Syrian conflict. President Bashar al-Assad and his allies in Tehran reportedly are now working together to build their force strength to launch a new initiative to quell the opposition and to fight off Islamic State. My colleague Jeffrey Young is following the story. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Well, Susan, I spoke about the issue with Syria analyst Chris Kozak at the Institute for the Study of War in Washington.
Currently, the Assad regime is in a tight situation. The regime has seen significant losses both in Idlib province in the north to a coalition of Jabhat al-Nusra and other allied rebel groups, as well as to the Islamic State in central and eastern Syria, particularly around the strategic city of Palmyra. These losses are driven in part by the regime's continued lack of manpower reserves. The regime suffers from a critical deficit of a lot of fighters, and Iran serves to provide as a backstop for additional reinforcements in the form of Lebanese Hezbollah, in the form of Afghan Shia fighters, and other proxy forces that Iran deploys on Assad's behalf. Currently, it can be expected that the regime is mobilizing, particularly to try to retake Palmyra in central Syria. However, the regime struggles to face multiple fronts. The regime is often caught in a zero-sum game, where any action taken on one front will spur drawdowns in its forces on other fronts in order to fuel the offensive. So I'm not very confident that Iran and Syria have the ability to muster sufficient forces in order to actually push back the opposition and ISIS at the same time on these multiple fronts.
Now, we have another element in this as well. The Islamic State, as well as its advances in Syria, also has advances in the last week or so, serious advances in Ramadi and other parts of Iraq. So if you have Iran trying to backstop Bashar al-Assad, you also have Iran trying to backstop Baghdad and the government of Iraq. I mean, how much resources does Iran have that they are willing to commit to this on two separate fronts?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very critical point. Iran is currently facing a regional problem, where as well as backstopping Assad and trying to prevent the Iraqi security forces from ceding more ground to ISIS, they're also facing, you know, challenges in Lebanon and in Yemen currently as well. So the Iranian attention is really diverted. In the more recent time frame, it looks like Iran's attention has been primarily focused on Iraq and using its proxy forces through Iranian-backed Shia militias, such as the Badr Corps or Sabah al-Haq, in order to advance and make gains and demonstrate the failures and the weaknesses of the U.S.-led coalition against ISIS and their air campaign in Iraq and Syria. The tension that Iran is going to face is that as ISIS continues to make these gains and continues to pressure Iraq in the Iraqi security forces, Iran has to make a difficult decision about how much resource it can actually commit to Syria. Iran is definitely vested in the success of the Assad regime, but at some point, Assad also has calculation to make where it may be worth not throwing full weight behind Assad and instead preserving something on the margins that is acceptable to Iran, some sort of post-Assad state in which the regime and its remnants are still active and Iran still has a say inside the country, but where the resource demands for Iran are not nearly as high as they are currently.
Syria analyst Chris Kozak at the Institute for the Study of War.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Also here is social media reporter Michael Lippin. Say, Michael, what is the Twitter world saying about the developments in the Syrian conflict?
Thanks, Susan. I've been taking a look at what people are saying on Twitter about the apparent new campaign by Syrian President Assad and his chief ally Iran to try to defeat rebel forces in Syria. One article that's getting attention is a piece by in Foreign Policy magazine by Philip Smith, and that's titled "Assad Strikes Back." It talks about how President Assad's government is under strain, but says rumors of its impending demise are greatly overstated. Smith writes that using cash and coercion, Assad has launched new efforts to bolster troop levels and engender further loyalty. Just last week, the Syrian regime announced its hope for a $1 billion credit line from Tehran to continue the fight. Now, that foreign policy article also drew a response on Twitter from the U.S.-based rights group Human Rights Watch. Its executive director, Kenneth Roth, who uses the handle @KenRoth, asks the question, with Assad more dependent on Iran than ever, why won't Iran stop him from barrel-bombing civilians? Now, that's a reference to repeated accusations by rights groups and others that President Assad's air force has dropped barrel bombs on civilians in rebel-held parts of the country.
Well, what other stories about Syria are in the spotlight on Twitter today?
Well, NBCNews.com has a story by James Novigrad with the headline, Al-Qaeda in Syria says, our focus is Assad, not the West. In that article, Novigrad examines a rare interview given by the leader of the Al-Nusra Front, that's Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, with the Al Jazeera Arabic language TV network. The NBC News journalist writes that the Nusra Front chief, Abu Muhammad al-Golani, told Al Jazeera that he is under orders from Al-Qaeda's leadership not to attack Western interests in Syria, but rather focus on toppling President Assad. In the interview, al-Golani says, the orders from Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri are that we should not attack the West from Syria because it won't help us and it may complicate the situation. Susan?
Well, thank you, Michael. That's reporter Michael Lippin. You're tuned to VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. I am Rick Pantaleo. Scientists have long been fascinated with Europa, one of the four largest moons of Jupiter. NASA says that the icy satellite is one of the most likely places to find life beyond our Earth. President Obama's proposed 2016 NASA budget includes funding for the space agency to plan an unmanned mission to Europa to find out if the mysterious moon has conditions that are suitable for life. The mission, called the Europa Clipper, took a significant step forward recently when NASA officials picked 9 science instruments that will be packed aboard its planned solar-powered spacecraft. The instruments selected for the Europa Clipper's scientific payload will gather data that could help scientists unlock the mysteries of the giant moon. NASA is planning to launch the Europa Clipper sometime in the 2020s. And that's your science in a minute.
Airstrikes by the Saudi Arabian-led coalition in the Yemeni capital Sana'a has killed dozens of pro-rebel forces. Reuters news agency says scores of civilians were among the casualties along the Saudi-Yemen border. Thousands have died since a regional Air Force coalition began an offensive against Houthi fighters in late March. Masoud Shajara is chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, one of over 50 organizations reportedly that have written to the UN Secretary General urging him to bring pressure on Saudi Arabia to end its military campaign in Yemen. Welcome. What do you hope to accomplish with this letter?
Well, we actually seeing that this sort of attack and bombardment of Yemenis, which has resulted in death and destruction in a country which is one of the poorest country in the world, is not achieving anything whatsoever. And the situation as it is in Yemen, at the best of time, 90% of food and medicine is imported into a country, and the blockage of anything going in is creating huge catastrophe for the ordinary innocent civilians. And we actually feel that this needs to come to an end, and we need to find a political solution, because this military activity is bringing no solution whatsoever.
How would you move forward with a political solution?
I think the beginning of the political solution is actually the end of the bombardment. And as we know, and indeed all military experts will testify that no war is won by bombing, and let alone bombing the infrastructure and the civilians. So really, I think at the outset, we need to stop the military action and through United Nations find the solution. And as I said, it's madness, because the current situation will bring no benefit to anyone, and is creating a huge catastrophe for one of the poorest countries in the world.
Could you describe the living conditions in Yemen and what these bombardments are doing?
Well, it's destroying what little infrastructure is there. It's becoming very indiscriminate, and many men, women, and children are perishing directly as a result of bombing, but also indirectly because food and medicine is not getting through. Hospitals are not functioning. There is no electricity. It really is a huge catastrophe, and all the international agencies are testifying to that. This is why we had such a huge number of people from civil society and NGOs right across the world writing this letter to the Secretary General of UN. Something needs to be done, and something needs to be done very urgently.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Here are the headlines. Two major European football associations called on FIFA's president to resign ahead of presidential elections planned for Friday. The United States filed charges of lies, corruption, and bribery against the sport's international governing body on Wednesday. 47 counts were filed against 14 current and former top officials. Iran's foreign minister says he is hopeful that Iran and a group of world powers can reach a final agreement on Tehran's nuclear program within a reasonable period of time. However, Mohammad Javad Zarif also said during a visit to Greece Thursday that there will be no agreement if there are excessive demands by other nations involved in the negotiations. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter said Thursday that defense officials are looking at ways to enhance efforts to train and equip pro-government forces in Iraq as they battle Islamic State fighters. I'm Frances Alonso, VOA News.
Coming up on International Edition, an international human rights group makes an appeal concerning FIFA, and our gang sits down to talk country music. FIFA is swirling in scandal following a sweeping investigation of the soccer organization. A U.S. indictment includes 47 counts against 14 current and former top officials, covering charges of racketeering, wire fraud, and money laundering in a scheme that prosecutors say involves sports media executives paying or agreeing to pay millions of dollars in exchange for marketing rights to tournaments. This is all happening just as the organization is to vote on a new president. Human Rights Watch is calling for the new FIFA leader to make sure host nations for the World Cup comply with human rights norms. On the line with us right now from Italy is Nicholas McGeehan, a spokesman for Human Rights Watch. Could you tell me what your organization is looking for with FIFA?
Yes, I mean, the FIFA elections are there's a little bit of uncertainty right now because of the corruption arrest yesterday in Zurich. But essentially, the elections are going to go ahead, and what we're looking for is for any new president to ensure that human rights are a key element of any decision for future tournaments. The reason we're asking for this is that we've seen that the 2018 and the 2022 tournaments have been given to Russia and Qatar, respectively, both of which are quite known for their serious abuse of migrant workers. So we're really hoping to ensure that that doesn't happen again.
How can the president ensure human rights?
Well, what you could do, for example, is in a bidding process, you could ensure that there's a due diligence process and that any candidates have to say how exactly they're going to protect migrant workers or anyone involved in the construction of a holding of a major event. And you could lay down some clear benchmarks, what's acceptable and what's not. And that's really what we're looking for FIFA to do, or the next FIFA president to do.
Can you tell us a little bit about these migrant workers, how they're not getting their human rights?
Well, I work specifically on Qatar, where the situation is pretty grim, to be honest. The situation in Qatar is that migrant workers are subjected to a labour system that actually allows for trafficking and forced labour. Their passports are confiscated. They pay very high recruitment fees to get jobs. They're tied to their employer, which means that even if the employer doesn't pay their wages or puts them in dreadfully substandard housing, or makes them work incredibly long hours in very, very hot temperatures, there's nothing they can do about it. And that's why we describe the situation as being one of similar to forced labour in too many cases. It's a bit of a scandal, really, that the World Cup, the world's preeminent, certainly soccer tournament, is being built off the back of this type of exploitation from workers from some of the poorest countries in the world.
I know Human Rights Watch is never to leave any stone unturned, so I'm sure you've probably gone to Qatar officials and brought this issue up.
We have numerous times. We do research in the labour camps outside of the capital, Doha, and then we take our findings to the senior government ministers who, to their credit, meet with us and talk about the issue. But I think the problem with Qatar is they continue to believe that much of the research is exaggerated, that we're focusing on a few of the worst cases rather than the reality, which is really a systematic system of abuse and exploitation. So we've been happy, I think, with the fact that the engagement, shall we say, but very disappointed with the response, in particular the reforms which they've announced, which are woefully short of what's required.
Well, thank you very much for your insight. I certainly appreciate you taking time to talk with us today.
Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
That was Nicholas McGeehan speaking with us from Italy.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics, or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is pcusa@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
A pair of country music veterans return to the studio. Tragedy at a Trace Adkins show. And Luke Bryan is kicking the dust up on tour. VOA's David Byrd and Nikki Strong hang out in the studio to talk country music.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and I'm here with Nikki Strong. We're talking country music. Let's start off, Nikki, with a couple of veterans of country music, Merle Haggard and Willie Nelson.
Yes.
They have a new album out called Django and Jimmy. Tell me a little bit about it.
So Django and Jimmy, the album is going to be released June 2nd. So, and it's in honor of their two respective heroes. So Django Reinhardt, who is considered one of the best guitar players in the world.
Right.
And one of Willie Nelson's biggest influences. And then you have Jimmy Rogers, which is country music's first superstar.
Right.
And pioneer of the genre itself.
And someone to whom Merle Haggard has credited his love for country music, for listening to his songs.
Yes, he actually did a whole album in tribute to him. So, and what's really good is that both Willie and Merle are good friends.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be good synergy. It's going to be good music. And they got together back in 1983 with Poncho and Lefty.
Sure.
Yes, so this is a long time coming. So
wow.
I'm looking forward to hearing what they have in store. They also, on the CD, have a tribute to Johnny Cash.
Mm. Now, I understand both were really good friends with Johnny Cash, and they all had their Johnny Cash stories, and so they sat down and wrote this tune about him.
Yes.
And Johnny Cash, of course, died a few years ago, so he's another pioneer of country music and of rock and roll, too.
Yeah. I love the fact that they're two legends in their own right, paying tribute to legends.
Now, they have a song on this album called It's All Going to Pot.
Yes, they do.
Smoking some weed in the studio, were they?
Yes, of course. If it's Willie Nelson.
Okay. Well, now, see, most people associate country music with drinking.
Willie has been very forthcoming with it, and even with this song, you know, and the video. They're very much like, light it up and let's go for it. And I think in light of everything that's happening in terms of legalization of marijuana, they're like, hey, let's sing about it. What the heck?
there was a bit of sad news. There was a Tennessee man who was arrested after running over some people at a Trace Adkins concert. Now, apparently this fellow had a little bit to drink.
Yes.
Was a vendor.
Yes.
And got into a dispute with somebody and then decided to run over them.
Well, what was crazy, he got into a dispute and then he went back to his SUV to get a gun, actually. This is what witnesses are reporting.
Mm.
And then he got into his SUV and then drove it into a crowd of people who were, you know, hanging around after the concert.
Wow. He went right into a field. And it took someone else driving their Jeep into him to stop.
Wow.
Yeah. So okay. one person well, died.
He has been arrested. This fellow yes. has been arrested and is facing some pretty serious charges.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Luke Bryan.
Luke Bryan.
His album Crash My Party had 6 number one singles on
yes.
it. It earned him 2 Entertainer of the Year awards.
Yes.
He's got a new one out called Kill the Lights, and we've got the first tune from that.
Yes, the CD Kill the Lights is set to be released Friday, August 7th.
Mm.
And he is really on fire right now. He has a new exhibit at the Country Music Hall of Fame that opened last week, mm-hmm. highlighting his career. And he's kicking off the Kick Up the Dust tour right now. So in honor of the tour and in honor of just some good country rocker music, this is Luke Bryan's latest.
All right, it's called Kick the Dust Up. And if you have any comments or questions, you can always log on to our website. That's www.voanews.com. That's where you can also find Nikki's show.
Yes.
And we welcome your comments. Thanks for listening.
Kick the dust up. Let's kick the dust up.
And thanks for kicking the dust up with us today. If you'd like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, visit our website, voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab. It's up there in the right-hand corner. And scroll on down to International Edition. Appreciate you listening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Neglected tropical diseases, or NTDs, are chronic disabling illnesses that thrive in areas with poor sanitation, lack of clean drinking water, and scant access to medication. The World Health Organization has identified 17 of them as priorities for action. Some of them can be effectively treated and even eliminated with low-cost medications, in many cases donated by pharmaceutical companies. Getting these medications to where they are needed has been a daunting task, since these are diseases of the poorest of the poor. Their impact on individuals and communities can be devastating. NTDs impair intellectual development in children and reduce school enrollment. They limit the ability of infected individuals to work and thrive, thus trapping them in a cycle of poverty and disease. Today, over 1 billion people suffer from at least one NTD. In 2006, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, started a program addressing the 7 diseases that comprise 80% of all NTDs: lymphatic filariasis, blinding trachoma, onchocerciasis, schistosomiasis, and the 3 most common infections, the soil-transmitted parasites hookworm, roundworm, and whipworm. Back then, the program had a budget of $15 million to distribute 36 million treatments to 16 million people in 4 countries, said USAID Assistant Administrator Ariel Pablos Mendez. Today, it's $100 million and 240 million treatments distributed to 115 million people in 31 countries. The program is very successful for 3 reasons. First is USAID's partnership with the pharmaceutical sector, which has to date contributed $8.8 billion worth of medication. Second is USAID's partnership and coordination with the government of the United Kingdom's Department for International Development, which has allowed for a collective reach to almost 50 countries and the provision of 340 million treatments in 2014. And third, USAID's cooperation with host governments and the ability to build upon the existing infrastructure of national disease control and elimination programs. The elimination of these diseases of extreme poverty as a public health scourge is within our grasp, said USAID Assistant Administrator Pablos Mendez. USAID is committed to working with countries and our global partners to reach the remaining 800 million people who still need treatment.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.